It is Friday, the 13th of November. Good to have you with us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Coming up, Islamic State attacks and others attack it, plus finding a peace partner inside Syria.
Certainly to the Syrian government and its supporters, Iran and Russia, any of those that have been deemed as terrorists, which is almost anybody fighting the Syrian government, are deemed as unacceptable.
Also ahead, the crisis in Burundi, and later, Maggie Smith's latest film. Everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Islamic State militants are claiming responsibility for twin suicide bombings in a Beirut suburb that happened late Thursday that left dozens dead, more than 200 wounded. The blast targeted a busy commercial and residential neighborhood controlled by Hezbollah, whose fighters back Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Hezbollah representative Bilal Farhad said they targeted civilians, worshippers, women, and the elderly. He said it only targeted those innocent people. This is a satanic terrorist act, he said, carried out by apostates. Meantime, Kurdish fighters, backed by intense U.S. airstrikes, have beaten back Islamic State fighters and recaptured some territory around Sinjar, a strategic town in northern Iraq close to the Syrian border. Edward Uranian is following the story from our Middle East Bureau.
Iraqi government helicopters pounded Islamic State positions around Sinjar as warplanes from the U.S.-led coalition attacked Islamic State fighters. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters who are leading the ground assault cut the main highway linking Mosul in Iraq to Raqqa, the center of Islamic State operations in Syria. The route is used by the Islamic State to transport weapons, fighters, illicit oil, and other commodities that fund the militant group's operations, according to the U.S. Central Command. About 7,500 Peshmerga fighters are participating in the battle. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A second round of international talks is scheduled in Vienna tomorrow on ways to end the nearly five-year Syrian civil war, with a key item expected to be how to decide the opposition groups with which Damascus is willing to negotiate a political solution. In a communique following last month's first round, the 17 world powers plus the UN and the EU agreed on the importance of accelerating diplomatic efforts to end the conflict, and with a UN-led effort to reach a ceasefire. Regional analyst David Lesh of Trinity University told VOA's Victor Beatty, while President Assad's future also remains a key obstacle to peace, the opposition remains fragmented.
And finding a so-called acceptable opposition, certainly to the Syrian government and its supporters, Iran and Russia, any of those that have been deemed as terrorists, which is almost anybody fighting the Syrian government, are deemed as unacceptable. What's interesting is that many of those are also deemed unacceptable by a number of countries in the West, including the United States, such as Ahrar al-Sham, which many would say is a radical Islamist group that is kind of a homegrown version of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. And of course, groups like ISIS are totally off the table. So finding an acceptable opposition, if you just get the opposition that the Russians want or that the Syrian government is willing to negotiate with, you have very little legitimacy amongst those Syrian opposition who have been fighting and dying for almost 5 years now. You know, that's a very small portion of the opposition. The crux of any political settlement depends on whether or not you can get the Syrian government to agree to concessions that are constitutionally encoded without caveat that can satisfy at least the minimum demands of a critical mass of the opposition. I just don't think there's any way right now that the Vienna talks and the list that people are drawing up are going to come up with a critical mass of the opposition who can bring enough of the opposition to the table, particularly, you know, via a ceasefire, which seems to be what everyone's working for before you even get to, you know, the many issues that divide Syrians today. But can you get enough of them to the table at all? And I don't think you can right now.
How can the West and Russia come to an agreement on the opposition?
Well, it's going to be a lot of horse trading. Each side at some point have to make concessions. with regard to who they deem the acceptable opposition, acceptable in terms of being an opposition group with whom the Syrian government could agree to negotiate with. Right now, the Syrian government, basically anybody that's fighting it, is a terrorist group. And Russia has, and to a certain degree Iran, has adopted that same definition. So the Russians and the Syrian government and the Iranians, and particularly the Russians and Iranians, probably will have to put pressure on the Syrian government to open the net wider in terms of who is an acceptable opposition. And I think the West will as well. I think the United States and European countries will have to accept certain armed Islamist opposition groups that aren't Jabhat al-Nusra, that aren't ISIS, as negotiating partners, or else you're just not going to reach that critical mass.
David, there appears to be a Russian proposal that is being circulated that calls for drafting a new constitution within 18 months, put to a popular referendum, followed by early presidential elections, but it makes no mention of President Bashar al-Assad stepping down during any transition period. What do you make of that?
They're trying, I think, the Russians to, through early elections, bring some legitimacy to Bashar al-Assad. And, of course, many in the West and many players in the region, you know, want to see quite the opposite.
David Lesh says the burden is on Damascus to state what political reforms it's prepared to discuss, including amendments to the Constitution that, he says, must be preceded by a ceasefire. Meanwhile, he suspects Russia is disappointed the military intervention has not translated into more victories by the Syrian army, backed by Iran and Hezbollah. He says opposition forces faced with Russian airstrikes have stiffened their resolve and received more assistance from Gulf Arab states. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Authorities in Dubai are holding a Yemeni member of the Emirates police force on suspicion of murder after he shot and killed another officer inside a police station. Violent crime is rare in the United Arab Emirates, a seven-state federation that includes Dubai. The Emirates and Saudi Arabia are the leading coalition of countries battling the Iranian-backed Shiite rebels in Yemen. And as for that conflict in Yemen, my colleague Sarah Williams has the latest.
The UN Special Envoy for Yemen said he was confident that peace talks between the government and Houthi rebels will probably be held in mid-November in Geneva. Ismail Weld Sheikh Ahmed said his team was in contact with the Yemeni parties to discuss the modalities of the UN-brokered peace talks. However, the warring parties are relentlessly escalating the fighting. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Steve Sesh, a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, to analyze the situation. Mohammed, if the parties agreed to send representatives to the peace talks, why is the escalation?
Usually, Sarah, in a situation like this, parties are trying to get the best gains before negotiations start, as Ambassador Sesh explains.
I think both parties are trying to cement the positions they have on the ground and perhaps even claim more territory, greater leverage, and more momentum. So when they go into the talks, they'll be in a position of greater authority, if you will, to be able to try to extract some concessions from the other side. I hope this doesn't suggest a lack of commitment on the part of each side, because each side has said it will send representatives to the talks once they are underway.
Ambassador Sesh argued that the involvement of Saudi-led coalition in the Yemeni conflict helped indeed in facilitating an opening to a possible negotiated settlement by forcing the Houthis and their allies to retreat and accept the 7-point peace plan brokered by the UN. However, he said, the real test now is how to implement it.
Well, I certainly think that this is the crux of the matter now. What is going to be the blueprint, if you will, the roadmap by which central authority, a legitimate authority, will be reestablished in Yemen, a central authority in Sana'a? It may begin in Aden as it is already, but it may also then need to shift back to the capital in Sana'a and have the world begin to see with some confidence that a government is once again in place. And I think this is also part and parcel of the issue of how do the fighters then, the Houthi fighters and others, withdraw from the cities, pull back to more neutral locations so they're not seen as a threat to the composition of this government.
Mohammed, usually peace talks following a conflict need outside encouragement, if not pressure, to produce results. What kind of steps are needed to improve chances for a successful conclusion of these talks?
Well, according to Ambassador Sesh, negotiating in good faith is a must. But also, all parties should pitch in to facilitate a long-awaited end to the Yemeni conflict.
That is International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy speaking with my colleague, Sarah Williams. The UN Security Council sent a united message to the fighting parties in Burundi on Thursday to stop the violence there and resolve their issues at the negotiating table. Violent attacks and clashes have killed at least 240 people since April and sent tens of thousands fleeing inside the country and beyond. President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for re-election 4 months ago, despite what many Burundians see as an absolute constitutional ban on a third presidential term, has been a major factor in the country's political crisis. Amnesty International has been calling for UN and regional action in Burundi for some time. And Sarah Jackson, Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes region, speaks now with VOA's Jota Kabwa about the crisis in Burundi.
Well, killings in Burundi have continued unabated in recent weeks. Bodies are being found in the streets on a daily basis. And we've seen in the last week an increase in inflammatory language by government officials. So the situation in Burundi is getting worse and has the potential to spiral into outright crisis.
What can be done to stop it?
Well, regional actors are taking the lead on the mediation. The East African community, under the leadership of President Museveni, is expected to mediate in this crisis. But so far we've seen the mediation has reached a stalemate. It's absolutely essential now that the mediation is restarted so that there's a dialogue and a political solution to this political crisis. The African Union has been very strong in their words in October, calling for dialogue, threatening targeted sanctions, calling for human rights observers to be placed on the ground. It's now essential that these words turn into action.
You mentioned sanctions. I believe France is currently circulating a draft resolution before the UN Security Council calling for sanctions. Do you feel sanctions are necessary now?
We think that sanctions could be, if they're targeted against specific individuals who have a responsibility for this crisis, could be one useful tool to encourage dialogue, to deter human rights abuses, and ultimately to try and resolve this situation.
You're also calling for independent human rights observers to be allowed in and also the protection of residents from further violence. Do you feel that the independent human rights observers would be safe going to Burundi?
Right now, it's just so important to have more eyes and ears on the ground, more people witnessing what is happening, so that one day there can be accountability for this and to dissuade actors from further human rights violations. We hope that the situation is such that the African Union can safely deploy human rights observers on the ground now and increase in number those that they have there already.
Do you think African Union troops are needed to keep the peace in Burundi?
We're not currently calling for the deployment of the African Union troops, but we understand that discussions are ongoing regarding a possible contingency force if mass atrocities were to occur.
A number of people, including Rwandan President Paul Kagame, have warned that Burundi may be on the verge of a Rwanda-like genocide that occurred in the 1990s. Do you feel Burundi is on the verge of such violence?
At the moment, what we're seeing is political violence, politically targeted killings. With the government's deadline for the end of disarmament in so-called opposition neighborhoods and the inflammatory rhetoric by government officials over recent days, we are concerned about the potential for mass violence on political lines.
Sarah Jackson is Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes region. She was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Well, that controversial hunting episode in Zimbabwe, which resulted in the death of the lion known as Cecil, has brought attention to the issue of trophy hunting. Now, some 4 months after Cecil's death at the hands of an American hunter, VOA's Anita Powell looks at how the hunting debate has changed.
Call it the Cecil effect. The killing of the black-maned Zimbabwean lion by an American dentist in July has reverberated beyond southern Africa and sparked a heated debate on what role trophy hunting should play in the region. And in a rare point of agreement, both sides of this debate agree that the lion's death has brought about positive change and greater awareness of trophy hunting, whether you agree with it or not. Zimbabwe Professional Hunters and Guides Association Chairman Louis Muller says the highly publicized death of Cecil inspired his organization to take a hard look at itself and to try to do things better.
The Cecil effect has affected everybody, not just Zimbabwe. It has affected trophy hunting as a whole in the entire globe. I think we realize that we've got to be more transparent as an industry. I think we've got to clean up the act and be more self-regulatory so that where there are rogue elements within our industry, we've got to address them and be very serious with these individuals before the authorities step in. We've got to clean up our act before the politicians step in, because then there'll generally be a knee-jerk reaction.
Hunting advocates argue trophy hunting is a good way to cull herds and preserve fragile environments. Muller also says the income from trophy hunting helps children by bringing income and investment to rural communities. An official with the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Isabel Wenzel, says her group is totally against trophy hunting. She calls it a blood sport. But she says Cecil's death has opened the door for positive change.
It's caused a huge outcry, but it has forced a few governments to actually sit up and notice that there's something maybe needs to be done, that there must be a reason why that it's caused such an outcry. So there has been different steps in the direction of legislation. Even in our country, there's definitely been a better look at it. And of course, America is trying to bring in other laws. So yes, Sahita has caused quite a ripple effect.
This debate has come too late for Cecil. But as humans argue about what happened and how he has changed the game, the beloved lion, in a way, lives on. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
There is a Broadway and film song called Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend that's well known, but it seems like the high-tech world is also getting chummy with diamonds. For more, we turn to G. Abby Lee, International Edition social media reporter. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Now, before I begin, I wanted to give you a full disclosure. I stumbled upon this story because of an endorsement by the actor Leonardo DiCaprio. He's on Twitter, at Leo DiCaprio, and he tweeted this. Proud to invest in Diamond Foundry, a company reducing human and environmental toll by sustainably culturing diamonds. And he left a link to the company's website, which is diamondfoundry.com. That tweet got almost 2,000 likes and more than 600 retweets.
Yeah, I got you, G. So what does this company do exactly?
It produces diamonds as opposed to extracting them. The company explains it discovered plasma that allows atoms to attach themselves to a thin slice of diamond that's been extracted the old-fashioned way. The atoms then stack on top of the diamond's crystal structure and grow layers, making the diamond bigger.
Okay, so you do need some amount of diamond plucked from the earth to begin with. And what are these diamonds for?
The company claims they create jewelry-grade diamonds, so I'm guessing that's the main purpose. If they can produce diamonds that are just as brilliant as conventional diamonds, that can really change the mining industry. The traditional way of mining diamonds is known to harm the environment and use forced child labor in some cases.
Yeah, I see. Can we find this company on Twitter?
Yes, you can. Its handle is @DiamondFoundry, but it only has 11 followers and a couple of tweets so far. The account actually retweeted DiCaprio's tweet and added this: "After 3 years, we are thrilled to launch DFoundry. Thank you, Leo DiCaprio, and all our investors. Forever starts now." I'm sure many of our listeners know this already, but just wanted to add that DiCaprio played a gem smuggler in the 2006 film Blood Diamond. Steve, back to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, G. That is International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is @GAbbyLee. You can also find International Edition on Twitter. We're @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Business had been picking up for the past several years at the Red Sea resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. That's until a Russian passenger plane crashed in October. Since then, hotel operators and businesses have seen revenues plummet.
Before the incident, we were at about 92% occupancy, guests in house, doing quite well. Now here we are a week later, we're at 60% occupancy.
Basil Kader manages the Sultan's Gardens Hotel, employing more than 500 people. He says the decision by the UK and Russia to suspend flights to the area is having a domino effect on other industries, which indirectly rely on the tourist trade.
It's about all the staff or all the people who support the tourism industry indirectly, whether they be suppliers, transportation, insurance companies, you name it.
Tourism accounts for 6% of Egypt's economy, and last year, Russians and Britons made up 2/3 of Egypt's 3 million visitors. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, there's a new movie out there starring Academy Award winner Maggie Smith. That's right, mirrors the real-life experience of British playwright Alan Bennett with a homeless woman who he let live in his driveway. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about that film, titled The Lady in the Van.
Many fans know Maggie Smith from her role as the Dowager Countess on the hit drama Downton Abbey. But Smith has shed her upper-crust finery in the halls of Highclere Castle for a rusted van parked in London's Camden Town in the new film The Lady in the Van. The story follows the real-life encounter playwright Alan Bennett had with Mary Shepherd, a homeless woman who lived in a van in his driveway in the 1970s. After he helps Shepherd, a former concert pianist reduced to living in a Bedford van, she ends up staying in his driveway for 15 years. Nicholas Heitner, the former director of Britain's National Theatre, directed the movie. He says that The Lady in the Van features many of the same locations on which the real-life drama played out.
The house is more or less unchanged. The study you see in the film is as it was. I visited it often. I've been directing Alan's plays for a very long time now. The street is, I think the street has not changed for 150 years, apart from the cars parked outside the houses. The van, obviously, is a replica, not the real van. And when it came driving up the street for the first time, I think a lot of the neighbours had very mixed feelings about that. Because she was not a great neighbour.
Olivier Award-winning actor Alex Jennings plays Alan Bennett, who is eventually cast into a caregiving role, one he has refused for his own mother, whom he committed to a nursing home.
I don't encourage her to think she can become Prime Minister. I do encourage her to try and get to the supermarket.
Yes. A carer will often feel that he
Excuse
or she...
Excuse me, may I stop you? Do not call me the carer. I am not the carer. I hate caring. I hate the thought. I hate the word. I do not care and I do not care for. I am here. She is there. There is no caring.
Jennings says that Bennett approved of his performance in the film.
And he's now gone on record as suspecting that I always did him. And I've now been given the opportunity to go public with it. But having him around has been fantastically important and his suggestions and his criticism sometimes, and his support has been a huge part of the whole process.
Jennings says that working with Maggie Smith and her approval of his performance in The Lady in the Van gave him a big confidence boost.
I just am in awe of the equipment she has, the kind of number of tools in her tool bag. Phenomenal. From, you know, she started out in revue, she can do high comedy, she can do low comedy, she can do raw naked tragedy. She's the breadth of what she's got is extraordinary, and it was a real privilege on this to sort of witness that. And she's fantastically collaborative and supportive.
Smith's performance has won over the critics, but Heitner says he's not sure she is willing to play the games necessary to win an Oscar.
This is a career that goes back more than 60 years. She's got two Oscars already. She worked with John Ford and George Cukor. She played Betty Davis's maid, so I think she's probably happy to stick.
The Lady in the Van opens in the UK this month. It opens in the United States in January. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
I wonder whose laugh that was. Well, here in the U.S., an aging mobster who stayed mostly in the shadows for decades by adhering to the mafia's strict code of silence was acquitted on Thursday of charges that he helped plan the legendary 1978 Lufthansa Airlines heist, retold in the hit film Goodfellas. Federal jury reached the surprising verdict at a Brooklyn racketeering trial, where it was heard testimony that portrayed the 80-year-old Vincent Asaro as a throwback to an era when New York's five organized crime families comprised a secret society. They committed brazen crimes and, oh, well, the things they did you wouldn't want to know. Thanks for tuning in to the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In conjunction with the visit of Judith Heumann, the Special Advisor for International Disability Rights for the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa pledged financial support through the Ambassador's Special Self-Help Program, or SSHP, and the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, to five projects initiated by different Ethiopian organizations to work on disability and development issues. The five organizations are among the 20 new grantees who won the 2015 SSHP and PEPFAR Small Grants Award competition from the 180 initial applicants. The grants are aimed to help the recipients to produce assistive devices, including crutches and walkers, promote inclusive public libraries equipped with Braille and computer software to enable visually impaired clients to use the computers, and provide HIV/AIDS awareness training, prevention, and support services for people with disabilities. The individual grants for these organizations range from $8,000 to $25,000. The $90,000 total award from the U.S. government will have a positive impact on over 1.7 million Ethiopians from Asosa, Awassa, Mekele, Jima, Arsi, Gondar, and Ambo provinces through various capacity building and livelihood interventions. Speaking at the signing ceremony, U.S. Ambassador Patricia Haslick said, "The ambassador's special self-help program and PEPFAR's small grants reflect the United States government's commitment to inclusive economic development for Ethiopia's most marginalized communities, including people with disabilities. In Ethiopia, the SSHP and PEPFAR offer small-scale, short-term support for projects that intend to benefit the larger community and bring tangible improvements to people's lives. The United States is proud to work with its partners in Ethiopia to help meet the development needs of the Ethiopian people."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.